Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is September 5th, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Won't Be Fooled Again, TPA for CVA. Our guest skeptic today is Dr. Ryan Radecki. Ryan is an assistant professor of emergency medicine, the University of Texas Medical School at Houston, and he has an amazing blog called Emergency Medicine Literature of Note. It is billed as musings on publications and studies relevant to emergency medicine and otherwise. You can follow Ryan on Twitter at emlitofnote. Welcome to the SGEM, Ryan.
It's a pleasure and an honor, to be sure, eh?
Oh, thanks for switching out of American to Canadian, eh? Now, this will be the first episode of Season 3 of The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, and the goal continues to be to cut that knowledge translation window down from 10 years to 1 year. The SGEM does this by using social media to provide you, the listeners, with high-quality, clinically relevant, critically appraised, evidence-based medicine. It's all part of the Free Open Access to Medication, FOAM movement. FOAM is medical education for anyone, anywhere, anytime. Now, Ryan, you're a big guy in FOAM, aren't you?
Well, if by a big guy you mean I spend more time interacting with strangers on the internet via Twitter than interacting with my own family, you, sir, are correct.
Ryan, I was warned by Jeremy Faust and Lauren Westifer of FOAMcast that season threes can be dangerous. Let me assure the SGEM listeners there will be no jumping of the shark. Do you know what jumping of the shark means?
Well, jumping of the shark means it's a saying that's come out of conventional wisdom to describe when a show starts to decline in quality. And the example they give is from the show Happy Days, in which the show was sort of on its downward spiral, and which was finally evidenced by an episode in which the Fonz is out water skiing and jumps over a shark. It was the beginning of the end and sort of an exemplar of how the quality of the show had degraded to unwatchable.
Well, the SGEM will not degrade. We are on an upward trajectory, and we will continue to provide a weekly podcast of critically reviewed and recent emergency medicine publications. We'll use the validated and reliable best evidence in emergency medicine, BEAM, critical appraisal tool, to review manuscripts. Guest skeptics will be invited to help give a variety of opinion. There will be more SGEM classics with the Swami on historic must-know papers. We will, of course, have cheesy theme music, mostly from the 1980s, to help with the edumatainment factor. And, of course, cool skeptical prizes will be awarded to the keenest listener who answers the trivia question at the end of each podcast. I am also working on an exciting new segment for the SGEM, tentatively called Hot Off the Press. Can't provide any details right now, but I hope it will cut the KT window to down to less than 1 week. Yes, 1 week, Ryan.
Well, if you can't provide details, anything secret must be good.
Oh, yeah, it will be so good. But let's start off season three without jumping that shark, and why not address again one of the most hotly debated issues in emergency medicine, thrombolysis for acute stroke. The SGEM does not shy away from controversial issues. It just follows the data.
So thrombolytic therapy for acute ischemic stroke remains widely controversial. A recent pro-con debate in the BMJ was accompanied by a non-scientific poll, and the results split nearly 50-50 regarding whether the benefits of TPA were adequately proven. Many professional organizations have recommended thrombolytic therapy, with treatment under 3 hours preferred, but treatment up to 4.5 hours accepted. However, other professional societies, primarily in emergency medicine, have been less enthusiastic about TPA. The Australasian College of Emergency Medicine suggests additional evidence is necessary, and the Council of the American College of Emergency Physicians recently voted to revise a pro-TPA clinical policy statement. Alternatively, many stroke neurologists feel tPA to be beneficial in many patients currently excluded from treatment. This includes the very elderly, greater than 80 years, and very mild strokes, stroke scales less than 5, and even time windows up to and beyond 6 hours from stroke onset. Active clinical trials are underway addressing each of these questions, as well as trials evaluating the utility of advanced imaging to select patients even further from the onset of symptoms. It's kind of a bit of an odd situation where it seems half of clinicians are trying to hold up and validate the existing trials, and the other half of clinicians are racing ahead in the opposite direction.
Well, let's frame this podcast with a case then. And we have a 78-year-old man presents to the emergency department with right leg and arm weakness for the last 4 hours. He has a history of hypertension and dyslipidemia. His vitals are unremarkable, except for a blood pressure of 165 over 95. A non-contrast CT head is performed that shows no acute intracranial pathology. Your stroke team asks you to administer thrombolysis and admit. So the question for today's podcast, Ryan, is what?
Is thrombolysis safe and effective treatment in patients who present with signs of an ischemic stroke of less than 6 hours duration?
Some background information is that acute ischemic stroke represents the leading cause of disability in our society and the third most common cause of death. There have been many studies performed looking at thrombolysis for acute CVA. And we've covered the original 1995 NINS article on episode number 70, The Secret of NINS. The bottom line from that manuscript was I was skeptical that thrombolysis has benefit for acute stroke. I presented 12 major trials for thrombolysis in stroke at the Swedish National Emergency Conference earlier this year at Sweet Beam. To summarize, there were 4 trials stopped due to harm or futility, 6 trials showing no benefit, and only 2 showing benefit. This was not enough proof for me to reject the null hypothesis. So Ryan, what new article came out this summer in the area of tPA for stroke?
This is a Wardlaw, Joanna M. et al., Thrombolysis for Acute Ischemic Stroke Review in the Cochrane Database of Systematic Reviews, 2014, July 29th.
So let's give the PICO statement. What was the population they were looking at, Ryan?
This is 27 randomized trials involving 10,187 patients with definite ischemic stroke.
What was the intervention?
Any thrombolytic agent, urokinase, streptokinase, tPA, recombinant pro-urokinase, or desmodoplase.
And what was the comparison they were using?
Placebo.
And what was the outcome they were looking at?
The primary outcome was functional independence at long-term follow-up, and the safety outcomes were spontaneous intracerebral hemorrhage and death from any cause.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, thrombolytic therapy given up to 6 hours after stroke reduced the proportion of dead or dependent people. Those treated within the first 3 hours derived substantially more benefit than with later treatment. This overall benefit was apparent despite an increase in symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, death at 7 days to 10 days, and death at final follow-up, except for trials testing tPA, which had no effect on death at final follow-up, end of quote. Ryan, there are 7 quality checks for systematic reviews. I'd like to run through those with you now. Question number 1, the clinical question, was it sensible and answerable?
I agree.
Number 2, the search for studies was detailed and exhaustive?
I agree.
The primary studies were of high methodological quality?
I believe this is uncertain.
The assessment of studies were reproducible.
I disagree.
The outcomes were clinically relevant.
I agree.
There was low statistical heterogeneity for the primary outcome.
I definitely disagree.
And the 7th question on the quality checklist, the treatment effect was large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant.
I disagree.
So let's address the results section of this Cochrane review. Now, in their evaluating of the 27 trials, the authors performed 39 analyses with some multiple sub-analyses. They also tended to focus primarily on those involving TPA or alteplase as the approved and guideline-recommended therapy. This Cochrane review is 164 pages. It's a good thing we have foam resources like the Skeptic's Guide and EM Lit of Note to help digest this big data dump. So Ryan, what were the key results of this?
Well, the main result, if you want to call it that, addressing their author's conclusions, thrombolytic therapy, up to 6 hours, debtor dependent. This analysis involved 23 trials with 9,318 participants. Overall, 54.7% of patients allocated to thrombolysis were dead or dependent versus 58.9% of patients allocated to the control group. This is an odds ratio of 0.85 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.78 to 0.93 in favor of thrombolysis, but these trials had statistically significant heterogeneity. Looking at the safety outcome, thrombolytic therapy up to 6 hours, the risk of symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage. This is 25 trials with over 10,000 participants. 7.4% of those allocated to thrombolysis sustained symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, and 1.7% of those allocated to the control group did. And this is an odds ratio of 3.75, favoring the control group, and there was no heterogeneity between trials. And then last but not least, for the safety outcomes, thrombolytic therapy up to 6 hours, risk of death from all causes. This is 28 trials worth of patients, another 10,000 patients. 19.4% of those allocated to thrombolysis were dead at long-term follow-up versus 17.7% of those allocated to the control group. This is an odds ratio of 1.18 favoring the control group, and there was significant heterogeneity between trials.
But these trials included the urokinase and the streptokinase, the other thrombolytics. And most modern thrombolytic therapy is typically undertaken with alteplase or TPA. How about just giving us the results for the TPA trials?
So just looking at TPA, the results are actually even a little bit better for thrombolysis. TPA, up to 6 hours, dead or dependent. This is 8 trials with 6,729 participants. Those results give us 54.2% of those allocated to TPA as dead or dependent at long-term follow-up versus 57.9% of those allocated to the control group. So this is an odds ratio of 0.85 favoring TPA, and this is with significant heterogeneity between trials again. Then, if we look at the TPA that we're conventionally used to, within 3 hours, this is dead and dependent again, they look at 6 trials with 1,779 participants. And of those, 59.2% allocated to TPA were dead or dependent at long-term follow-up, compared with 68.3% allocated control, which is an odds ratio of 0.65 favoring TPA without heterogeneity now that we're under 3 hours.
So the authors therefore lead their published abstract conclusion with the sentence, quote, thrombolytic therapy given up to 6 hours after stroke reduces the proportion of dead or dependent people, end of quote. But Ryan, let's provide some critical appraisal on this. I mean, this Cochrane review was an update of a 2009 version through the addition of the third international stroke trial, or IST-3. And this is the largest stroke trial to date. To remind listeners, IST-3 enrolled patients up to 6 hours and specifically enrolled those who were not eligible for TPA under the current European license, but where the treating clinician believed TPA was promising therapy.
Yeah, this is a very interesting trial with a bunch of problems. It started out with a minimal initial number of patients enrolled in a double-blind phase, but following the approval of TPA in Europe, Boehringer Ingelheim ceased supply of the study medication to IST-3 in order to focus on other trials. This resulted in a transition to an open-label design in which both the treating clinician and the patient were aware of the treatment allocation. This introduces several forms of bias, including alteration of the type or intensity of other initial treatment based on that allocation, a placebo effect after giving this quote-unquote promising therapy, and conversely, a nocebo effect if the patient is randomized to no additional treatment and expects that they might be harmed by that randomization. Outcome assessments at 6 months were blinded to allocation, but many occurred via telephone or even postal mail, and they're relying on unblinded patients or unblinded family members to report the functional status. So this trial is subject to substantial limitations to internal validity, and its inclusion in this updated Cochrane review, comprising over half the total number of patients treated with thrombolytic therapy, diminishes the reliability of the overall analysis as a result of biases in favor of thrombolytics.
Yeah, Ryan, there were a number of problems with IST-3. Like you mentioned, it was a open-label pragmatic trial, so that brings up blinding. It was a small blinded trial to start with 300 patients approximately, and you know, that favored the control, not TPA. And then only patients doctors thought would benefit. So, I mean, of course there's bias there. But they missed their target by about 50% for enrollment. And then after 7 years, they seem to have moved their goalpost. They brought in another statistician who persuaded them to come up with this secondary outcome with ordinal logistic regression analysis. And the primary outcome was negative, and yet they reported this as a positive study. Quote, despite the early hazards, thrombolysis within 6 hours improved functional outcome. Benefit did not seem to be diminished in elderly patients, end of quote. The SGEM did do a critical review of IST-3 on episode number 29. And the bottom line from that review was treatment with TPA harmed, and that was death, 1 in 25 early. The fatal and non-fatal bleed rate went up significantly, and there was no benefit seen at 6 months in their primary outcome. But Ryan, we got to get back to this 2014 Cochrane review. Can you bring us back to that?
Well, a lot of the biases you talked about, the authors actually appropriately note many of these threats in their reporting of potential sources of bias. Only 14 of the 27 included trials met criteria for high-grade concealment, which is the blinding essentially you're talking about. Other than IST-3, however, most were double-blind, placebo-controlled trials. Although the authors note the saline placebo used in many trials may not actually be identical in appearance to TPA, as TPA tends to have a foamy appearance when reconstituted. Patients treated with TPA can also have prolonged incidental bleeding from venipuncture sites or from their gingiva after treatment, and that can unblind patients or clinicians in the acute phase. Blinding of follow-up assessment was only explicitly declared in 7 trials, which may have resulted in clinicians aware of some of these acute phase events or acute allocation performing the follow-up assessment.
Well, we mentioned earlier that several trials were stopped prematurely as a result of safety, futility, or enrollment issues. Atlantis A was stopped after 142 patients due to an excess of symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage. Atlantis B was stopped after 619 patients due to futility. And the authors note data has only been publicly presented on 547 of them. ASC, MAST-E, MAST-I, and MELT were all stopped early by their data monitoring committees. OST was discontinued after slow recruitment. The authors do not acknowledge the distorting effect of early termination when waiting results for pooled analysis.
And these authors also downplay the potential bias resulting from trial funding and author affiliation. They note, quote, 8 of 27 trials were run by companies that make the clot-dissolving drugs, end quote, but go on to state most participants come from trials funded by government or charity sources. However, this statement is only true based on the inclusion of IST-3. The majority of trials and patients comprising the remaining participants, including most trials evaluating TPA, were funded by Genentech and Boehringer Ingelheim. all TPA trial reports were co-authored by individuals declaring conflicts of interest with one of the two manufacturers, or even authored by employees of one of those companies. All these trials were also performed in specialized stroke centers, and patients were assessed by expert neurologists prior to enrollment and treatment. The generalizability of any of these findings to many practice settings is limited, and observational studies show mixed results regarding safety and rate of treatment of stroke mimics.
The simple summary of this review boils down to the reliability of the evidence, rather than the analysis of the authors. However, after nearly two decades of TPA, most clinicians' opinions are fully crystallized. Regardless of the conclusions or analysis in this article, few will change practice. Ryan, let's try to put the author's conclusions and compare them to our critical analysis or conclusions. And just to remind everybody, the authors wrote, quote, "Thrombolytic therapy given up to 6 hours after stroke reduces the proportion of dead or dependent people. Those treated within the first 3 hours derive substantially more benefit than those with later treatment," end of quote.
So in fact, those treated with TPA after 3 hours derived no benefit according to their analyses. Analysis 1.19 reports death or dependency at follow-up for those treated between 3 to 6 hours, and it gives us an odds ratio of 0.93 with a confidence interval of 0.83 to 1.04, so a confidence interval crossing 1 versus control, which means there was no benefit. Therefore, even accepting this data with all its reliability issues at face value, the authors present a misleading conclusion by partitioning the data as a 6-hour chunk rather than appropriately parsing it into a 0 to 3 and a 3 to 6-hour chunk and just presenting the 0 to 3 hours as beneficial and beyond 3 as not.
The remaining authors' conclusions regarding a definite increase in symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, death at 7 to 10 days, and death at final follow-up accurately reflect consistent harm presented across all trials, though.
The harms from TPA are definitely consistent. There is no heterogeneity across the trials, and the authors accurately report that. The authors also call for additional trials aimed at identifying the latest time window, treatment population, and trials to reduce harms from intracranial hemorrhage, and to identify the appropriate environment for practice. However, my take on the data, it may rather be more appropriate to perform additional trials to narrow the treatment population in order to maximize benefit rather than to expand the treatment population to the very limit of this risk-benefit balance.
Ryan, do you think you can give us a bottom line for all of this?
Bottom line, no true believers on either side of the issue are harmed by this publication.
Well, my bottom line was thrombolysis for CVA. I still remain skeptical. Let's bring it back to the case resolution, though. This 78-year-old man who presents to the emergency department with his right leg and arm weakness for the last 4 hours. Your stroke team had asked you to administer thrombolysis and admit the man. You reassess the patient, and he seems to be improving clinically. You discuss the potential benefits and potential risks of thrombolysis. By now, it's over 4.5 hours, and the treatment window is closed. The patient is not given TPA, and he is admitted for further care.
This is a challenging case in my mind because we're clearly in a realm of uncertainty. There are few risk stratification and prognostic tools out there to predict outcomes with TPA, but this patient is far from that ideal treatment population. His age, hypertension, and dyslipidemia are clinical features likely increasing his chance of intracranial hemorrhage. In these trials, in a typically younger population, the symptomatic ICH rate was 7.4%. Just roughly estimating, his chance of ICH after TPA is probably 10 to 12 or even higher percent, with a corresponding increase in mortality. You mentioned he has unilateral weakness, but it is improving. Is this a transient event? It is difficult to say so close to the onset of symptoms. Stroke mimics and TIAs also do great with TPA, but they also do great without treatment. the level of disability is an important consideration. A patient with some weakness might be reasonably expected to regain some function with rehabilitation, whereas profound hemiparesis is almost certain to be completely disabled for the remainder of his life. Many individuals will actually make the decision to take that substantial risk of bleeding in order to gain an even small chance of independent living. An assessment of pre-stroke functional status is also an important consideration. Then, as you say, this patient presents near the end of this proposed therapeutic window. In general, and in this specific case, I would say the risks even exceed the theoretical benefits.
So, Ryan, how are you going to take this new Cochrane review and apply it clinically in your practice?
So I will continue to offer TPA as recommended by the American Heart Association guidelines and tacitly mandated by medical legal consequences if not offered. However, the manner in which patients are provided informed consent for this therapy can dramatically influence their likelihood of electing to receive treatment.
Well, then what do you actually tell patients when presented with this type of situation?
So I tell them, thrombolytic therapy for acute ischemic stroke is controversial. The risks, severe bleeding and neurologic worsening, are consistent and known and occur in about 1 in 12 patients. The benefits are uncertain, and most studies suggestive of benefit were sponsored by drug companies or otherwise biased. Other trials showing harm or no benefit were stopped early when hoped-for results did not materialize. However, a number of patients in these trials using TPA, about 1 in 10, received noticeable functional benefit from this therapy when given quickly after a stroke. Doubts persist about the reliability of this data, and unfortunately, it is unclear which patients have the greatest chance of benefit or harm from this therapy. The choice to receive this therapy remains an individual patient decision.
Well, let's get off the controversial issue of TPA and stroke into something a little bit more exciting, like a Keener contest. Ryan, do you have the first Keener contest question of the year?
I do, and the first question is, who did the first study for thrombolysis in acute ischemic stroke, and when was it published?
If you know the answer, then send me an email to the SGEM @gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first person to correctly answer the question will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now we have some upcoming conferences this fall. There is QBeam in Quebec City, September 29th and 30th, and Eurobeam in Prague, December 5th and 6th. I want to thank you, Ryan, for being the first guest on season number 3 of the SGEM.
Kicking off our Jumpin' the Shark season in style.
Well, I hope it was a good way to launch season number 3. You can look forward to a weekly skeptical review of the EM literature. As mentioned, the Swami will be back with more classic papers. You can expect more great guests like Ryan, and I will be recording an SGEM Journal Club at Queen's University next month. There will also be the occasional 10,000-foot view of an emergency medicine, medical education, or evidence-based medicine issue. And, of course, that secret brand-new SGEM segment coming soon. Ryan, as the skeptical guest, you get the honor of giving the tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.